You are listening to an entertainment program put together by a company called Financial Ineptitude. Anything said on this show is not an endorsement or professional advice. Would you really want to tell a court of law you were suing us because you thought taking financial advice from two idiots on a podcast put out by Financial Ineptitude was a good idea? Really? Clown hat, smiley face.
Financial Ineptitude presents Two Bulls in a China Shop. You can find our podcast at twobullsinachinashop.com or just search Two Bulls in a China Shop wherever you stream your podcasts.
Hello and welcome, everyone. You made it to the China Shop. I'm shopkeeper Dan. With me, as always, is Kyle, creator of financialineptitude.com. Kyle's celebrating a big promotion today.
Oh, God,
he
again.
Is the new apprentice horse shouterer. How are you doing today, Kyle?
Well, I can't be a whisperer.
Oh, I've never heard you whisper in my life.
Whoa! 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 Heel!
Stop this fucking horse!
Oh, God.
You doing good today?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm doing all right. Market's been pretty down today. Kind of depressing, but oh, what can you do?
You learn how to make money when it's down.
That's exactly.
Well, we are joining you here today in the shop. Glad you everybody made it. We've got a special guest with us today. Chris Mamula from CanIRetireYet.com. He's here with us, and we're going to play him in with a nice little ditty for your earballs.
Now it's basic investing with the bulls in the shop, rising up to the challenge to go viral. And you must be a buyer, never sell those shares off, because we're holding them all with an eye to retire.
How are you doing today, Chris?
That's awesome. That was great intro music, too. I'm fired up now.
Right. That's a good one.
So we're very glad you've joined us today. Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey into becoming a retirement guru?
So it kind of happened, I guess, by accident. I was, by training, I was a physical therapist where my financial education was basically non-existent. And mm-hmm. so... My wife and I lucked into this path to FIRE, financial independence, retire early, that I'm now on, just because we both grew up without having a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so for my family, like, debt was just the four-letter word. And like, it was just, you didn't have debt, you just didn't do that. And my wife grew up with a very different background where her family kind of struggled with money. And so she just wanted to do something totally different. And so we both got, you know, professional jobs. I was a physical therapist, and she's had a variety of careers with pretty parallel career path to mine, though. Mm-hmm. And so we both made probably as much money as our whole household did individually. And so we just started living off of one salary and banking the other, just really because it felt secure and mm-hmm. having no idea what the heck we were doing, not thinking early retirement was a possibility for us. And, you know, like a decade later, you wake up and you have a six-figure portfolio and a paid-off house. And we started looking of what are our options. And that's when I found other FIRE bloggers and realized that maybe this is possible. And so that's kind of how we had that big head start to kind of to have a decent net worth and a good start before we actually figured out what in the heck we were actually doing with investing and tax planning and all the technical stuff that I write about now.
So you are retired now, correct?
Yeah, I was a physical therapist, and I worked from, I guess, 2001 to 2017, and I left my job in December of 17, and I haven't practiced since, and I just let my license go. I was kind of keeping that door open for a couple of years, and then at the end of 2020, between being out of work for 3 years and the pandemic, there wasn't a lot of demand for, you know, non-essential healthcare workers, and I just decided not even to bother doing my continuing education, and I just let it lapse, so I am completely retired, and I guess I kind of closed that door on ever going back to being a physical therapist.
Now, were you keeping that door open because there was still some fear?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think when we started down this path, you know, like, there was a lot of talk, as there still is now, and it's actually, I guess, worse, but like really high stock valuations, really low interest rates, like, did we have enough money? And that first year was kind of scary. In 2018, there was a decent dip in the market towards the end of the year, and but ever since then, everything's been on an upward trajectory. And then also, like, I started a little hobby business as a writer, and I've written a book, and I started working on the blog. And those now bring in nowhere close to what I was making as a physical therapist and nowhere close to covering our expenses, but enough that probably if I needed to, we could not take anything but just the earnings off our investment. So that kind of eliminates the
right.
the risk that, you know, you're drawing down too much. So all of those factors kind of played into it. And so I felt much more comfortable after a couple of years.
Allow me to butter you up a little bit. I consider physical therapy to be essential in healthcare. I don't think enough people consider it as an option. I have a friend who's got a very bad back, and they'll go to the chiropractor, but not a physical therapist. I'm like, what are you doing? Go to the physical therapist.
That is the correct answer.
Okay. I remember my question was now. You said you and your wife kind of grew up with different backgrounds. I was curious, does she have a different philosophy when it came towards debt? Because it sounded like you were of the mindset of, you know, debt, you don't want it, stay away from it.
No, you know, we were both very set on being debt free. She put herself through school. She worked full time while going to school full time, just with this idea that she wanted to kind of limit her debt. So, like, I knew she wasn't in any way irresponsible, but it's expensive to put yourself through school. And we are from Pennsylvania, where college costs are one of the highest in the country. So she wasn't able to get out debt free. And so, like, we kind of just settled on this system before we were ever married. We kind of agreed that we were going to go into marriage debt-free. Mm-hmm. And so I actually helped her pay off her loans with my first couple of paychecks. And my last year while I was in grad school, I was working part-time. We were just crushing her debt. And so we've been debt-free since we were married in, I guess, 2001.
Wow.
Did your family utilize debt a lot as a kid growing up? Or were they also, did they instill those values on you? Or did you learn from watching what not to do?
For my family, it was much more learning from a positive environment. Mm-hmm. My parents were definitely anti-debt. Like, they made a big point of pointing out that, like, they didn't buy cars with debt. They only bought used cars that they could buy with cash. And, I mean, they used a mortgage for our house, but I know they paid it off early. I remember that was like a celebration in our house, like when I was probably in my early teens. So, you know, I never actually have gone back and talked to them about how long it took or what their plan was, but I know they definitely paid their mortgage off early because we were mortgage free pretty early in life. And they had, again, they didn't have a very big income. My dad was he had a photography business and my mom worked with him in it. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, combined, they made well under, you know, probably mid like 50,000, 60,000, somewhere in there, max maybe. But they were able to like get my brother and I through school and help us. And so they were very responsible. Just my mom, I would give her credit for knowing how to stretch a dollar. It's actually kind of funny talk about like financial literacy and stuff. Like when they got married originally, to give you an idea of kind of their background, my mom worked in a bank and they got married and my mom's supervisor came in and she said, you know, like, I need to talk to you. And she called her in the office and shut the door. And they're like, what the hell's going on? Cause like you guys are bouncing checks. And my mom's like, what? And so she looked and she went and talked to my dad and he thought like if there was checks in the checkbook, there was money in the account. Oh. And so he was just writing checks. And so like that's kind of their background. So yeah, like it was definitely my mom that was really good with stretching a dollar and kind of knowing what to do with that stuff. And yeah, so that's, yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah. We all learn and get better. But yeah, they did pretty well in the end.
That was an expensive lesson, I bet.
Yeah, that was a very awkward conversation, I'm sure. I would have loved being a fly on the wall for that one.
Right. I actually was lucky enough to have a lot of those same values, I think, instilled on me from my grandparents. They were very big on no debt load, buying used. My grandma grew up in East Germany during World War II, so she knows how to stretch a dollar, too, believe me.
Yes, I'm sure.
But I think that, that was such a key towards my financial independence. I think that what can we do to help other people get that same access to that kind of information? Like that seems to be one of the biggest problems, I think, with the world today is that nobody really understands investing or savings or debt load or credit or any of this stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just people. I think it's made so complicated when really the processes aren't that hard. And that's kind of what we try to emphasize on the blog and in my book. Just try to really focus on just understanding that it is doable for normal people with normal jobs. Like you don't have to, like I just kind of explained our background, but you don't have to come from wealth. You don't have to have this massive income like where, you know, you're a doctor or you're a Hollywood star or you're, you know, cashing out on a startup, like normal people can do this. And that's kind of really the message we want to get across. Cause I think a lot of time it's just that simple of people seeing that it's possible and that mm-hmm. and that inspires action. Whereas a lot of times people are just drifting because they don't understand that it's possible. Because I mean, I think that the industry has made it so complex to get started investing and to really understand what is the things that matter and what things move the needle.
Yes, but it's also gotten a lot easier too these days too, wouldn't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with the advent of the internet and things like Vanguard and index funds, yeah, I mean, it's a different world even than when I started investing, you know, when I got out of school in 2000.
I mean, yeah, I think I started in 08, Dan. You started even younger than that in before high school, right?
Oh, I started dabbling, but I wasn't successful and I didn't stick with it for any long amount of time.
Well, yeah, did you buy Enron?
No. I bought a utilities company and then Enron happened and then just all the utilities companies just took a dive.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. I had a dividend reinvestment plan. So my idea was like, I'll put this money in at 13 years old and let the dividends reinvest and then I can retire off of it. Then the stock tanked and they canceled the program.
And Dan learned about diversity.
Diversity, and I learned about sectors moving together. It's like, my power company didn't do anything bad. Why is it going down?
I was looking through your blog, and one of the articles that really stuck out was, I think it was titled "The Worst Advice I've Ever Gotten."
I think the worst investment advice I've ever seen everywhere.
Everywhere, yes, that's right. And that had to do with using financial planners. It sounded like you had a pretty terrible experience.
Yeah, well, you know, I thought I did at first. And then as I kind of dove into it, I realized what I had was a pretty standard experience if you're using commissions-based advisors, which was what mm-hmm. I was using. And I almost could put advisors in air quotes because, I mean, they're salesmen is what they are if we're being honest about it. And so they're going to kind of sell you the things that are in their best interest. And that makes sense once you understand it. But again, I kind of went in with not knowing what questions to ask. So I kind of told you, like, my parents, they did pretty well with not a lot as far as stretching a dollar. Mm-hmm. And they were investing. And I knew that they were in a position where they helped my brother and I with school. And so I kind of just, I guess my due diligence for finding an investment advisor is I went to my parents and I thought they knew what they were doing and I respected them. And I said, you know, who are you using? And they said, we'll introduce you. And that was the amount of due diligence I did. And I never asked a question. And whatever basically told us to do, that's what we did. So we went in and, you know, we were buying, you know, front-loaded mutual funds paying, you know, 5.5%. And then we were on the back end paying like 2% a year in expenses, not having an idea what expenses we were paying. Ugh. And then like he was having us, like we would go in and we say, like, what do you think about our 401k? And he said, well, we can get you better investment options, which were definitely better for him, but right. They were not better for us. We lost all those tax advantages. And because we were using taxable accounts, like not only were we not getting that tax deferral, then our investments, as we were building up, they were starting to kick off and they were all actively managed funds. So they were kicking off even more fees. And I mean, the taxes and the fees we were paying, I mean, it almost sounds unbelievable to people listening to this maybe, but I tallied it up, and in our last year alone, we paid like $20,000 in unnecessary fees and taxes. And if you would have asked me what we were paying, I had no idea. I would have probably said a couple hundred dollars. I mean, they're just so hidden so well, and if you don't know what to look for, so it was a painful experience.
Oh man, I'm glad you managed to pull yourself out of that. I think the phrase you used at the end was that your parents succeeded, but in spite of, not because of.
Yeah, I mean,
that
for
kind
sure.
Of stuck
like
with me a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, like when I first kind of realized kind of what advice we were getting and what we were paying for it, and I talked to them, and you know, like I think the financial advisors they really focus on building relationships and building trust, and I think my parents were almost like upset at us, like we would confront him and talk to him about it, and like they couldn't believe. And eventually, like now, they ended up firing the advisor too, and I actually manage my parents' money. I help them with their investments. But I mean, it took quite a while for them to even as I was, you know, getting serious about this and writing about it till they kind of came around. And I just, you know, I just said, you know, I think you're probably getting a bad deal. If you want me to sit down with you, I will. But it took them, I would say 2 or 3 years till that happened, until they kind of agreed to do that. And then ever since, it's been, that's what we've been doing ever since.
That's funny you mentioned the building trust and relationship, and then your parents being like almost mortified of the idea of saying, what are you doing? Or questioning him even. That's not the first time I've heard that.
Yeah, and if you look at some of the training things, like so, I told you, like my background, I was a physical therapist, but I also did sports medicine, so I was an athletic trainer, and mm-hmm. so I worked with high school athletes. And the one kid, he was one of our football kids, and we had a pretty good relationship. And he went off to college, and he called me, and this was like right after this was all happening, and I was starting to write about finance and stuff. And he went into school, and I guess like he got the instruction, like call everybody you know and get them to sit down with you, and because he was going to go into the investment advising business. And so I was like, I'll sit down with you, but I don't think you're going to want to hear what I have to say. but I mean, that's how they're trained. You get into these internships, and like they actually have you like reach out to your friends and your family and people that you trust. And most people don't know, you know, what they're doing. And that's kind of the crux of that article that, what's the worst investment advice that you hear everywhere is just that you need an advisor. And then how do you find one? Well, you should ask for a trusted resource to refer you. But it's the blind leading the blind. Like, again, like my right. parents, they totally trusted this guy. They were not trying to screw me over and send me to the wrong guy. They didn't know what to ask. And before I started writing about this stuff, I'm sure I sent 3 or 4 other people of my friends to this same guy. Because, yeah, he was doing great for us. Our money was going up. But, yeah, I mean, the whole market was going up. And
I hope you called those friends back.
I did, yes. I did. Some of them are still friends.
That's funny because that's, like, the main reason why I actually took up, like, doing the investing myself, like, picking out, trying to either pick stocks or park my money in, like, the SPY or something like that. I just did not trust anybody else to touch my money. I had a severe distrust of anybody being financially motivated to trying to manage my nest egg. And that kept me away from that completely and then made me decide to focus on actually learning it.
Yeah, but you know what? Like, I feel that way now. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned before about, like, why are people so intimidated? And I think they make things so intimidating. The industry does. And so even as I was learning how bad our advice was and I was learning about conflicts, like my initial thing was like, man, I can't do this myself. It's so complicated. And so my initial gut instinct was, you know, I just have to find a better advisor. And mm-hmm. I remember going in, so I have a physical therapist friend who was my partner in our office. And I said, you know, do you use somebody? Because he was pretty frugal. I thought I kind of got a sense that he was okay with his money. And, you know, money's so taboo. Nobody really talks about it.
Right.
And he said, yeah, I do. And I said, well, how did you find him? Like, how do you even know what to look for? And he said, well, you know, Dr. So-and-so and Dr. So-and-so, the two orthopedic surgeons we work with, he said, they both use them. And I know they have a lot more money than me. So if they're good enough for them, they should be good enough for me. And I was like, well, like they're good surgeons. Like, I would trust them to repair my rotator cuff or replace my hip or something. But
right.
that doesn't mean, you know, if you need an annuity, that doesn't mean, you know, like, you know, what your asset allocation should be. Like, they went to medical school. They're not investment. And that for whatever reason, when he said that to me, that's when the light bulb finally clicked. And I was like, you know, I got to figure this stuff out. And once I just dedicated myself to doing it, it's not very hard. But yeah, it's just that initial hurdle of knowing that it's possible.
Oh, that sounds like there's, you know, genuine incentive to keep it, like the shroud of mystery around it to try to convince people that they need that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if they're, you know, if people realize how simple it is, why would they pay the fees? So yeah, the more complicated you make it, then the more that they keep themselves in business.
Mm-hmm. Kyle, they're not going to teach you how to homebrew at a bar.
Well, here's the thing. They would if they can still make better beer than you.
Okay.
Well, right?
Maybe. I don't know. What bars do you go to?
I'm saying that there might be a financial incentive to teach somebody how to do it when you know that they're not, you know, this very small percentage of the people are going to have the actual skills to be successful at it.
Yeah, fair enough.
But when it's something like financial investing and you can level the playing field with, you know, 2 weeks worth of research. right. Yeah, that probably don't want to be offering those classes. I mean, didn't Dr. Han say that when he first started doing his instruction business, like just teaching people financial literacy, that there was nobody doing it?
Yeah, yeah, because he was looking for himself.
Yeah. Oh, let's shift gears a little bit. How about let's go on to some of the more nitty-gritty details of being retired. And this is of particular importance to me because, I mean, I don't consider myself retired anymore, more so that I took a new job working for myself. But health insurance is one of the biggest ones that always is in the back of my head. It was like the biggest obstacle why I couldn't do it. You mentioned several different options in one of your blog posts. So I was curious if you can expound on those, some of the different options you have for trying to secure that.
Yeah, I mean, first, I would just say I don't think there is one good universal option. And I think that's the biggest challenge that, that in my opinion, that I faced. And also just in talking to readers, that's the thing that hangs people up. Because, I mean, it's such a big deal. But I think the best thing for early retirees that's happened is, and some of your readers just hearing the name of it will, or listeners will get mad just because it's so political, but the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. But it's really changed the game. For being able to, really two things. Number one, just being able to buy insurance. If you had a pre-existing condition before, they could either deny you coverage or, they could, basically discriminate based on your past medical history, to the point where they could offer it, but it would be so expensive that it was pointless to even have insurance.
Right.
So with the Affordable Care Act, and there's definitely drawbacks to this. There's nothing perfect about this, but the nice thing, it cannot deny you coverage based on past medical history. And the only thing that costs are based on is your, aside from your location, your state, it varies a bit, but then your age and whether you're a smoker. That's the only things that affect your rates. And so that was a game changer for early retirees. And then the other part of it is there are subsidies based on your income. So if you have a low income, which most early retirees will, and you can kind of manipulate your income by it's based on your modified adjusted gross income. So it's based on that. So if you can keep that low enough and generate enough income to meet your needs, which most relatively frugal early retirees can, the insurance is really affordable with the subsidies. Mm-hmm. So those are the positives of it. The downside of it, it just went, had another challenge, really, I think 3 weeks ago, and the Supreme Court struck that down, but it's under constant political assault. So right. Like for myself, I'm 40. How old am I? I'm 45 years old now. And so I still have 20 years till Medicare. And like right. This law, I mean, every time there's a new administration, it's, you know, there's talk of repealing it or changing it. And I, even like last year, it actually got much better for the next 2 years, where they improved it for people that are on it now. But it's only for 2 years, and they didn't pass that law until like March. So like for my wife and I, we plan every year in December, and we just go year to year and figure out what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And they changed the law in March. So 3 months later, after we made a decision, it didn't help us a whole lot. And then it's only through 2022, but they made the subsidies much more generous, and they removed, there's called a subsidy cliff, where if you make too much, so maybe if you made, and I'm just throwing numbers out there, but say you're a married couple and you're making $60,000 of adjusted gross income. And before, if you were at that level, maybe you got an $8,000 subsidy. But if it was literally like if you made $60,000 one, wherever you crossed that threshold, your subsidy went away, which made it just such a nightmare to try to plan.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah.
Whereas now it's a sliding scale. So eventually the subsidies go away, but it's a much higher income, and it's like there's not that big drop off. So those are two big changes that just happened this year with the change in the law. But again, that's only for 2 years, and then who knows what happens after that. There could be a new Congress. There could be, you know, who knows what happens. So it's extremely challenging planning around a law that's so unstable.
Well, there's some other options that you had on there that I'd never even heard of, and I thought I had done some research, but one of them was like co-ops almost, or collectives.
Yeah, before we get into that, I think the one I'm more familiar with that a lot of early retirees are fond of is healthcare sharing ministries.
Yes, that's the one, yes.
Yeah, those are through like, they're nonprofit, they basically have a religious ideal to them, like where you're pulling resources based on like a Christian tradition of, you know, you support your, you know, your fellow people. But because they do have this religious aspect to them. There's behavioral things to them. So like, you know, if you drink alcohol and injured, you may not be covered or something like that. And like, even if you know personally, you're a responsible person, like I'm a physical therapist and I've seen people get hurt for really stupid stuff. and so like, you only have to get drunk one time or another thing is like pregnancy out of wedlock. Like that would be a Christian thing. And so like, if you have an unwed pregnancy and so like, you know, like I trust myself and my wife that we're not going to get that, but like I have a daughter and like, I know teenagers do things. And so do I really want to take on that risk, you know, a couple years down the road? I really don't want to take that risk. So like there's all these different aspects that you really have to be careful with these healthcare sharing ministries. And then the other thing is they're not insurance. So there have been instances where you hear of people not getting claims paid and you don't have a whole lot of recourse. There's definitely a cap, like whereas ACA plans, you know, Obamacare plans, they're not capped. So you have mm-hmm. no limit on how much insurance will pay out. Most of these have maybe like $1 million limit, which sounds like a lot until you have a serious medical condition and you realize that can happen pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So like to me, the role of insurance is to cap your big risk that you can't afford to take. And I don't know how well the health share ministries do. So that was something that we considered, but we didn't think it was a fit for us. And those are probably the two most popular things. And then there's other just little things like you have COBRA, which only lasts like a year or two. But if you're, you know, if you're like not a fire type early retiree, but like a 60 something year old retiree, that that might bridge the gap for a year or two. There's I'm not even sure what the status of these now with again, with the change of administrations, like with Trump, the Trump administration, like there was the option to get like the more catastrophic plans where you have much lower premiums, but they don't cover all the things that the Affordable Care Act plans do. And again, like you have that option where they can deny you once you get once you have an illness or an injury, they can just raise your premiums. They may not renew you. So you have all those risks that went into insurance pre-ACA with those. So yeah, there's a lot of options, but none of them are great. So I think for most people, the ACA is the best, followed probably by the health share ministries.
Yeah. That's the one that we're actually looking at too. I think with COBRA, you get like a little bit of a grace period too. I think up to 45 days after you separate that you can back opt into it.
I have to look into that. I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure it's a 2-year limit after you part service is 2, maybe 3 years. So yeah, it's not a long-term option regardless.
I'm saying you can skip out, you know, like just skip a month. And then if you get hurt, like, you know, 30 days after you separate, then you can go back and be like, oh, no, I wanted to pay it. Here's the premiums I missed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's kind of one of the things with the Affordable Care Act too, is like you can, and to me, this is a fault of the law, it's a positive for an individual, but it's one of the reasons the law doesn't work very well, in my opinion. But yeah, I mean, you can get an injury or an illness, and then as long as you can get by to the next open enrollment period, you can just sign up and you don't pay any higher premiums. And, you know, it's like you never had that. So to me, that's a flaw in the system, but it works to your advantage as an individual.
It's like when I buy an Apple product and don't sign up for the service, and then when it breaks, then I'm like, oh, can I get that warranty now?
Yeah, it's essentially, yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Just for your body.
Whoops, I do have cancer. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of the point of insurance that whoever wrote the law, it wasn't, I don't think, thought out as well as it could have been for a 500-page piece of legislation, but that's for another day.
Who's got time to read 500 pages?
So what other obstacles did you have to overcome when you finally made the decision to, like, what was the things that were standing in your way that you had to sort out before you could actually make the leap into retiring?
I think just the big mental hurdle. So, I mean, if you are a person, so again, I left my job I was 41 years old, and my wife and I, we saved basically one salary and lived off one. And that wasn't really precise. Like some years we actually saved more than that. Some years we saved a little bit less if we splurged and did a big trip or something. But in general, we were saving, let's call it 50%. And so you do that because you're comfortable saving. Like we talked about kind of the psychological aspects for both of us. And so when you go from saving 50% to retirement of drawing down your assets, like that's like, you know, you're speeding down the highway and then you slam it in reverse. And like for most people, that's not comfortable. And, like, you know, you can't save that much. It's like a crash diet. Like, yeah, you might be able to do that for a week or a month, but, you know, to achieve financial independence and to retire early for us, it took like 16 years. So, you have to do it because it feels comfortable. And so by definition, then it's going to be uncomfortable to start just turning around and drawing down. So what we had to do was kind of come up with a system of, you know, what would we do that would, you know, not feel so uncomfortable and not feel so stressful where we're always worried about money. Mm-hmm. And so what that ended up looking like for us is my wife still works part-time. And like we talked about, I kept my PT license for a while. But in the meantime, I was working on doing some writing and I make a bit of income from the blog and I wrote a book. And so like we kind of just do kind of some hobby work now and enough to kind of more or less get by without having to touch our investments. Some months we are net savers, some months we're net spenders. But it's not that traditional retirement that most people think of where you just cut everything off and you're spending down your assets. And so in the 3 years since I left my job, our investments have almost doubled. So now we're in a much more comfortable position.
Right.
And we've been gradually easing down where we're not really savers or spenders. And so when we do hit that point, it'll be much more comfortable, I think, to cut back and start, you know, living that more traditional life, retirement lifestyle.
It's funny you put that into words, but yeah, that was something I experienced last week when I paid myself my first check out of my account. I'm like, oh, so painful. It's going the wrong way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, again, like, it's just, you know, you don't get this way by, you know, if you have to struggle to save every month, then you're probably not going to ever get to that point where you're mm-hmm. able to retire at 40 or 50, let alone traditional retirement age, because, you know, you're spending everything and that's what's comfortable for you. And so, yeah, I mean, it's quite a shock to the system. And I think that doesn't get quite enough attention. People are just like, oh, yeah, I'll just do this and I'll hit financial independence and I'll quit. And it just doesn't really work that way.
Right.
At least not for us and for most of the people who I've talked to.
It's definitely something I've had to work on.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes a special person, I think, to be able to just rapidly change like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Dan, you got anything? I got one more topic I really want to cover, but I'll let you jump in.
Chris, what do you find when you come across people? What do you find their biggest obstacle and hurdle to retiring early is?
You mean like people, like blog readers, people that are close to retiring, or people like just getting started out, or like who are you asking?
I would say the people that you come across that are like coming across your blog and they're actively looking for a path, and they're saying, oh yeah, can I retire yet?
Yeah, so I think I've been meeting with, like, I typically set aside, and I haven't done it the last couple of months. We were on the road last month and stuff, but I'll meet with a couple of blog readers a month. And I think for a lot of people, I think it's just that idea of, you know, when do you have enough? Mm-hmm. And then just kind of having that courage to make the change. Because again, like, I think people are comfortable saving. And also, I think people focus a lot on the financial aspects, like, you know, how am I going to get health insurance? Do I have enough money? What are the taxes going to be? All those type of things. And I think people focus way too little on, you know, what do you actually want to do on the other side of retirement? And it's not, like, what I found is it's not necessarily an easy question. I think people like I'll talk to people and I'll say, like, well, what do you, like, they'll say, do you think I should retire? Do you think I have enough? And I was like, well, what do you want to do? And they're like, I think I want to start exercising. And I was like, well, do you exercise at all now? And like, well, no. I was like, well, why do you think you're going to exercise when you're retired? Like, I want to start doing this. Like, have you tried that? No. And like, well, do you think you might not like that? Like, that's something to maybe consider before you quit your job and upend your life. Because, for me, some of the things that I thought I would do, like, we moved. So I'm from Pennsylvania and we moved to Utah after I retired. And my wife and I just love skiing, and we would do a trip every year, and we have these little crappy hills in Pennsylvania, but we would go every weekend and ski from open to close, and like, we love skiing. And so, yeah, when we moved to Utah, now we have world-class skiing in our backyard. Yes, we ski probably 50 days a year. But then, nice. Like, other stuff, like, I never really was into, like I always felt like I should volunteer. Like, I just felt like I should be doing more, and I never really did. And I was always, like, I was too busy. And, like, that first year when I retired and I left my job, like, I think we had like a thing at our church at Thanksgiving, and I like served dinner for like 4 hours, and then I signed up to do something for like 2 hours. And like at the end of the year, I think I volunteered 6 hours, and it's like, why didn't I do more? And it's like, I guess it just really wasn't a priority to me. So it's not to say you can't change. And I have definitely gotten more involved in doing things with that now, but it takes a concerted effort. And so I think people just think like, oh, I'm going to retire. I have time. I'm magically going to change. And I don't think that's the case. Like, I think you have to be very intentional. And it's definitely something to think about, you know, before you get there, because a lot of people feel lost.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I think a lot of people do get their like almost purpose from their work. Like, the work is what defines them. And mm-hmm. if you suddenly take that away, you need something to fill that gap. You need something that's going to drive you or give you that sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think we thrive on, you know, accomplishment and service and helping other people. And yeah, when that, a lot of that comes from work for a lot of people. So when it goes away, a lot of people, I think, feel lost, and a lot of people end up going back to work for that reason.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I could see a lot of people taking like just a part-time job. I always told my dad he should just go get a job at the gun range, since he likes to shoot so much. Go work somewhere where you can get a discount for the things you enjoy doing.
Right.
Yeah. Like, that's what I plan on doing. When I'm done working, I'll go work at Radio Shack or something where I can get like the cool electronic stuff and fart around with.
Yeah. And that's kind of, I mean, a lot of the stuff I do, it's not even necessarily for money, but yeah, I mean, I volunteer, like, so I liked being a physical therapist. I liked the physical, like the, you know, working with people, mm-hmm. helping them get better, stuff like that. But like, I hated our medical system. It just sucked. And mm-hmm. so like now, like I do like adaptive skiing. And so it kind of scratches that itch for me, fills that need. And then I also get free ski passes to go to other resorts. Yeah. So I'm not necessarily profiting in money, but like, you know, it's tax-free. You're getting $100 ski pass to another resort and it's just stuff like that. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that you can be productive and use your skills after retirement. But again, it's something you want to kind of think about and, you know, have a plan and, you know, nobody's plan ever goes according to the way they thought it would. But at least if you're thinking about things, you'll have options and right. it'll be stuff you've considered.
What's that Mike Tyson quote? Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
I love that one. Yep. I use that all the time.
Okay. I want to pivot one more time here. There was one article I was reading too on your blog post, and you wrote it back in 2013. It was about the true cost of buying a home. I think the conclusion was that in many cases, renting was better than buying.
Yeah, that was actually my blogging partner, Darrow, he wrote that post. It's probably the most popular post on our blog still.
Yeah, I think it was the first one that showed up. I was just curious if you still felt that way, but I guess if you didn't write that, that's not
necessarily. Well, you know, I can tell you, he just bought a house this very right. recently. But I think it's a challenging question, and I think it changes from like right now, it's the housing market's just crazy. So it really mm-hmm. depends on what market you're in and also what you're going to do with that money, how you're going to invest it if you're, you know, if you're not putting it into a house or, you know, if you're using a mortgage. There's a lot of different factors that go in. And that article, if you're wrestling with that or if listeners are wrestling with that, definitely worth checking out. He put a lot of thought into that and it still does really well on the blog. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's the most read thing we've ever had. But it's a tough question and he really kind of dives into a lot of those different factors.
Shoot, I should have looked closer at the author because I thought we were going to have a good argument.
Yeah, I've always been a home, fallen on the home owner side. Me but too. For me, it's just more of an issue of just comfort. Like we paid our mortgage off in like 7 years. Mm-hmm. And when we moved, we sold our house in Pennsylvania and bought our house in Utah here with cash. And to me, it's just a comfort thing. I've never honestly broke down. Like I know he really dove into the analytics of the math of it. And for me, it's just some things I think it's worth doing that. And then other things, you just got to know what's going to make you sleep at night. And for me, not having a mortgage, like I know if everything went haywire, I mean, our expenses are so low because for most households, that's the biggest expense you have is your housing. Right. So by being able to eliminate that other than, I mean, it's, you know, you still have property taxes and upkeep and stuff, but not having a mortgage or a rent payment is just huge in my book.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main consideration is time. If you're only going to be somewhere for 6 months to a year, then yeah, why would you bother buying a house? But my argument for the pro side is that if it's better to rent, then why are rental prices more? Like, why is anybody buying houses to rent them out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously making money doing it.
Well, and one other thing, like if you and again, this is maybe a limited portion of the people listening, but like if you are an early retiree, again, like, so we talked about the healthcare and the subsidies. So it's the subsidies are based on your income. And if you don't have a lot of expenses, which again, that's the biggest for most people. So if you can eliminate that expense, then you can keep your income that you recognize every year lower for tax purposes, which means you get a much bigger subsidy. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into it and you really have to kind of look at your own situation and consider all of those things.
Well, Dan, I tried, but I guess we're not going to get our beef yet.
Oh, man.
We've been on a quest to find someone to start beef.
Yeah. Beef's good for business.
Sorry, I'm too agreeable. Sorry.
That's all right.
You know what? That pisses me off, Chris. You're too agreeable. I got beef with that.
Well, I was telling Kyle before we started. I mean, listen to how you guys invest and stuff. I thought this whole thing was going to be arguing. I've had nothing to argue about yet. This is a little disappointing. I was looking to lock horns with the bulls.
No. I think Dan defined it perfectly. We've always said to anybody who asks us what they should invest in, the SPY or an ETF that you like. Don't overcomplicate it.
Yeah,
agreed.
Yeah.
We're trying to beat the game with limited success.
Turns out it's hard.
It's really hard, and it requires a lot of time and effort. The people who are successful at this is their job. This is their 9-to-5, and then this is what they do on the weekends.
I just had this conversation with two friends. We were out hiking the other day and they were talking about that. And like, and kind of, that was my argument is like, I have enough interest in personal finance. Like I write a blog, mm-hmm. I've written a whole book and I have no idea. Like I can't answer, like they're asking, should I invest in this? Should I do that? And like, I can't answer any of your questions and I have way more interest than you. So why would you even think about it? Just buy an index fund and get back to hiking and biking and skiing and just go hang out with your kids and enjoy life. Like it, life's too short as far as I'm concerned, but I, if you like it, by all means, go for it. But for me, I've never had any interest.
We love it. Obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And some people do. And by all means, go for it then. But
yeah
that's not for me.
It's always going to be work.
Yes.
It's always work.
That's been that's my new go-to. I think if somebody asks me if they want to do what we do, I think I'm going to ask them if they go to a party and they have 30 to 40 minute conversations with people at the party about stocks. Then maybe you have a shot. Are people walking away from you because you won't shut up about Tesla or Apple? Or
have you ever had a loved one beg you to stop talking stocks?
To encourage you to start a podcast so you could talk to somebody else about it.
Yes.
Yeah, if that's not the case, then stick to an ETF.
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. man. Okay, well, I think we got through most of my questions, Dan.
Yeah. So, Chris, how can I make a ton of money to retire next week? I'm in a hurry.
Don't start blogging. That's definitely the wrong answer.
I am willing to break the law, just full disclosure.
I could tell you a lot of ways not to get rich quick, but don't buy a variable annuity from your commissions-based broker.
No, that's actually pretty good. Yeah, what is some stuff I should stay away from?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what else you should not do. Those are probably the big ones. Yeah, if you're going to get a degree, don't go a couple $100,000 in debt for a degree that's going to pay you $40,000. Those are the things not to do. But yeah, I don't know how to get rich quick.
Nobody wants to get quick-ish. Rich slow.
Yeah, quickish, a decade or two.
Yeah, nobody likes to get rich slow.
Well, what's your top three things that you'd tell somebody that is looking to retire or trying to start their plan, put their plan together? What's the top three things you'd tell them to do?
I mean, the top three, the number one, absolutely without a doubt, is to start by knowing what they're spending. Because I think a lot of people, they have no idea how much they need to retire. And when I say a lot of people, like I was definitely in that boat before I started like reading these FIRE blogs. And that was really a game changer for me was just kind of understanding like basically for a lot of the people in the financial independence community, like they'll use the 4% rule, meaning whatever your assets are. When you start retirement, you could take 4% of that. So say you had $1 million portfolio, you could take $40,000 a year.
Right.
And so the inverse of that then would mean you would need whatever you spend, you would need 25 times that to be financially independent. And so that's not a perfect rule by any means. And if you have a longer retirement with valuations and interest rates where they are now, stuff like that, you have to really modify that. But just knowing, like having a true north, I guess, that provides by knowing what your spending is. And then that gives you at least a goal to shoot towards, whether it's more than 25 or less than 25, depending on, 25 times you're expending, like depending on what else you want to do, if you want to keep doing some part-time work or if you want to truly retire and how young you are. But knowing your expenses gives you that place to start. And I think that's a big thing for people because if you don't have a place to start and you don't have a hard goal, it's really hard to make progress towards anything. Right. So I think that's the number one thing is just starting there. As far as the other two, I don't even know. I think like from an investing standpoint, I think a lot of people overcomplicate things. I think like we break it down into three things you can do in the book. And one is just simple index investing. The problem with that is a lot of people, like I said, we save 50%. So that works really well if you have a high savings rate. But it doesn't work so well if you're saving 10%. It just takes you a really long time to get financial independence. And so if you're not going to do that, like I know you guys like dabbling with little things, but you know how hard that is to beat the market. So I think areas where you can beat the market are investing in real estate. And right now it's maybe challenging because prices are so high. But if you can use leverage, you can use sweat equity, you can do a lot of different things. So if you treat it as a business, I think in real estate over the long term can be one of those ways you can do better than in stocks and bonds. And then the other is just your own personal business. If you have a skill and you are willing to put in the work, But again, they're totally different strategies. They're not passive like stocks and bonds are. So, but I think those are just kind of finding what your needs are and then matching your investment philosophy up with, you know, your skills, abilities, and needs.
Well, Chris, can you tell us, you mentioned your book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the book is Choose FI, Your Blueprint to Financial Independence. And what that is, that's a podcast. There's a podcast called Choose FI. And when I was thinking about retiring, so I mentioned, like, I kind of had no idea what I was doing with investing and just with retirement planning in general. And I started reading all these FIRE blogs. And I was a big fan of the Tim Ferriss podcast. And he had a book called Tools of Titans, where he took all of his podcast interviews and turned them into a book. Hmm. And that was my long-term goal. I wanted to write a book with all these different people, but from the FIRE community, and interview them and then turn that into a book with, like, the best lessons. And so that was my plan. And then these two guys started the Choose FI podcast, and I was like, kind of exactly what I wanted to do. And so at first I was like, well, maybe they'll just suck and they'll fail. And I was kind of rooting against them. But I was listening, and I was like, they're actually talking to everybody I want to and asking the questions. And this is kind of exactly what I wanted to do. So instead of, like, trying to reinvent the wheel, I just reached out to them and I said, hey, what if we take the interviews and turn them into a book? And they were very receptive, and they kind of blew up, and they've gotten a much bigger audience. So it worked out well for all three of us in that they got a book and they didn't have to write it. And I had all the resources and all the legwork done, and we had an audience to sell it to. So it worked out really well. And so what the book is, we just take all these interviews, distill it down into key lessons, and we develop it into principles on basically the three key levers of how you spend less, how you earn more, and how you invest better. And then we also just look at, you know, what are you going to do after financial independence? And that's what the book is.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
We'll make sure we put a link to that in the episode description, so anybody listening can check it out. And also your website, caniretireyet.com.
Yep, that's where I, that's my home on the internet if anybody wants to connect with me. And I usually publish a new article every Monday, usually just once a week. So
wow, you're way better than I am.
I try. Doesn't always happen, but that's the goal.
All right. Well, should we move on to some fun and games, Dan?
Oh, I think so.
All right. I had a little trouble thinking of a good one for this, but I think we found something that should work.
All right.
All right. We're going to call this Retired or Fired.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I'm going to give you the name of a famous person, and you're going to tell me whether or not they were retired or whether they got fired.
All right.
Now, this is subjective, so you can kind of, this is for you to decide.
You can argue your point if we disagree.
All right, let's start with how about a recent one? Jeff Bezos.
I didn't know he was either. I guess I've not been following the news.
He stepped down as CEO of Amazon to focus more on SpaceX and some other activities.
Ah, man, I'm gonna call him retired. I would say he has enough. I would say he's able to retire, so I'm gonna call him retired. I think he's got enough based on the 25 times.
Well, I think a lot of these people fall under that category.
Yeah, I'm gonna call him retired.
All right. How about John Schnatter? You may know him as,
I don't even know who that
is. Papa John.
I feel like he did some stupid stuff, so I'm gonna say he got canned. I'm gonna call him fired. I don't know what he did. I'm not much of a pop culture person, but I
don't remember what he did either, but I remember it was bad.
I feel like it was something dumb.
Oh no, I remember what he did. He was doing a racial sensitivity call and decided to kind of do a here's what you don't say.
Oh god. Okay, yeah, he got fired.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh god, why would you think that? That's smart.
I don't know. I'm sure there's a little more nuance to it. Like if we had him on the show, be like, hold on now, here's what happened. But right. that's the article I remember reading.
From my understanding, money does not buy brains. So,
okay.
Well said. Well said.
This one is from Dan. John DeLorean.
Man, again, I don't even know who that is. I need to watch more TV.
No, this is an old one.
Did you watch Back to the Future?
Yeah.
Back to the Future?
You remember that movie?
Yeah, absolutely.
Remember the car that the time machine was made out of?
Yeah.
Do you remember what it's called?
It was a DeLorean, wasn't it?
Yeah, John DeLorean.
On a coin flip, I'm going to say he was fired, which is why you guys put him in there. But I have no idea.
I wasn't sure either. I had to look it up, and apparently he was busted in a coke deal. A bunch of other stuff happened.
Oh yeah, he's totally fired.
Okay. That's the way I was going too, but I wasn't sure.
Well, I'm glad he made the car first, or otherwise they would have been stuck back in the 50s, so that worked out well, at least for Marty McFly anyway.
God, what was that, the 80s? I mean, can you imagine if that was a Pinto? All right, last one. Let's do one more. Richard Nixon.
He was definitely fired. I know who he is.
Hold on. And was he, though? Was he, though? Didn't he step down before he was impeached?
Yeah.
I do know who he is, but I'm not a big political person. But I'm going to go with fired. I'm sticking with my answer. Trust your gut.
Dan, what do you think?
I'm siding with Chris here because it's kind of like when your boss is calling you in to fire you and you're like, you can't fire me, I quit. Like, well, yeah, but you wouldn't have quit if they weren't about to fire.
Oh, Dan, you know how much I love technicals. So technically, he stepped down before he got fired. They were going to fire him. They were going to impeach him. But he beat them to it.
All right. You're technically incorrect, Chris. I'm sorry.
No, there's no right or wrong on this.
Yeah. Yeah. You've ended the round minus $200, so we're going to need a cashier's check.
Yeah. We'll take promotion. All right, Dan. Why don't you wrap us up, I think.
Oh, well, Chris, this has been a really great chat. We really appreciate you coming here in the shop and talking with us about retirement, sharing your knowledge. We want to thank you very sincerely for coming out here. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, thanks for having me. That was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Glad to hear it.
Wish we could argue more, but otherwise.
Wish we'd had you a month earlier.
You're right. Yeah, before Kyle made his big move. Mm-hmm. All right, folks, so we're going to wrap up the shop today, close the doors, close the shutters, because we don't want anybody getting in here smashing our china. Only we get to smash our china. Them's the rules.
Damn right.
We will be coming back at you soon, and until then, happy trades.
Bye, folks. Thanks for joining us. You can find us off air at twobullsinachinashop.com. That's the number 2BullsInAChinaShop.com. Make sure you check us out. Download us on any streaming network, blah, 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 blah. You know what to do. Rate and subscribe.
Two Bulls in a China Shop is an entertainment program, and all thoughts and opinions expressed in the show belong to the hosts and not of any company. They are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide entertainment about stocks and the financial industry of trading. If you make trades based on what you hear in this show, you assume all risks for those trades.